This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Set aside what you think you know about human emotion, because our guest today says it's probably wrong. We're talking with Lisa Feldman Barrett, a professor of psychology at Northeastern University and author of the brand new book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Barrett says modern neuroscience debunks many long-held beliefs about emotion, especially the idea of a reactive animal brain wrapped in a more rational cognitive brain. And the importance is more than just theoretical, because these outdated assumptions, she says, still shape important aspects of our lives, from how our doctors react to our complaints to public safety policies like airport screenings and gun laws. It's a lot to think about today in The Exchange, so let's hear from you, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Professor Barrett, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, lots of misunderstandings and myths and old ideas to debunk this hour. So let's just go through them, Professor Barrett. You say right up front, emotions are not what we think they are. What's the biggest misunderstanding that most people have about emotion? You know, the one thing that you just keep running into again and again and again.
People believe that emotions are built in, that we're born with a circuit for anger, a circuit for fear, a circuit for sadness, and so on. And that these, when one of these circuits is tricked, that it initiates a facial expression, a particular diagnostic feeling, a body state, but kind of like a fingerprint for an emotion. So let's say if you something tripped your fear circuit, that it would cause you to look startled, feel terror, and then run or freeze. And the idea, this idea really goes all the way, can be traced all the way back to Plato, but in modern science, it's been with us, I would say, for about a century and a half in that form.
So the myth is that we're pre-wired. Emotions, as you say, are built in. You say you have to have knowledge about emotion to experience it. So if you were never taught to be afraid of a spider, to use a really easy example, you wouldn't be afraid of a spider.
Yes. In fact, we would go even further and say there really are no circuits for emotion in the brain. Your brain doesn't come with emotions built in. Your brain has a set of all-purpose networks. You can think of them like general ingredients, that these networks work together to create different recipes and of experience. So emotions are made. They are constructed in the moment, and they're constructed using one of the ingredients is what you know about emotion from your past, from your own parents labeling emotion for you, from reading books, from watching movies, and so on. And without knowledge of what anger is and what sadness is and what awe is in your own particular culture, it's really impossible for you to feel or to perceive those emotions.
So that's why the title of the book is not, you know, where emotions come from, but how emotions are made. They are created.
Yeah. Exactly. In fact, in modern neuroscience, I think one of the most important discoveries in the last 10 years is that the question of where circuits live, the idea that your experiences of the world reveal how the brain is structured. So because you have thoughts and feelings, that must mean there are different circuits for thoughts and different circuits for feelings. and which would lead neuroscientists to ask the question of, well, where are these circuits in the brain? And I think in the last 10 years, what neuroscientists, a growing number of neuroscientists have realized is that, in fact, your brain is populated with fairly general circuits which can do many things. And the more important question is, how is the brain constructing experiences? How is the brain allowing you to perceive your world? How is the brain controlling your behavior?
Wow. So one of the ways that this misunderstanding has come about, you write, Professor Barrett, is that a lot of it's been seen from a very Western perspective. But when you travel to different countries, it turns out they are not, I don't know how else to put it, emotionally triggered or emotionally reacting or feeling the same way that we do.
That's right. So there are some ingredients that are general across cultures. For example, all of us, our brain really controls our body, the systems in our body. And it, you know, so your brain will, in all cultures around the world, a brain will increase heart rate sometimes, decrease heart rate sometimes, change your blood pressure and so on. And everyone around the world experiences the sensations from these physical changes as very simple feelings of feeling pleasant or unpleasant, feeling worked up or feeling calm. But not all people around the world experience feeling unpleasant and worked up as anger or as fear. That's a particularly Western way of transforming an unpleasant feeling into a specific emotion. One thing we know about human brains is that they wire themselves to the social and physical circumstances that they live in. So people who live in a Western culture or who are exposed to Western culture will learn the concepts and knowledge of that culture, and they'll use that knowledge to create their own, to make their own experience. In some cultures, you know, in our culture, for example, we, much of our culture in the law, in economics, and much of everyday life, we have a distinction between thinking and feeling. And we elevate rationality to be this very, very desirable thing. In some cultures around the world, there is no distinction between thinking and feeling. They create very different kinds of mental states out of the same basic ingredients.
So this is getting into already, Professor Barrett, the nature versus nurture thing. And I have to ask you this question. I mean, are you saying then with this idea that emotions are created by the cultural context, by the family context, are our brains basically blank slates to be shaped by whatever context they find themselves born into?
Absolutely not. I think the nature versus nurture debate is one of the most misunderstood. It's one of the most misunderstood arguments in in all of science. So, I think a better way to think of it is like this: you're born with a set of genes, which creates a brain that is waits for a set of instructions on how to finish wiring itself.
I see.
So an infant brain is not, doesn't look like an adult brain. Obviously, you know, an infant brain is born with a bunch of neurons and a bunch of wires connecting those neurons together. So, and if you look at all human brains, they, you know, have, if you look at them, take off your glasses and kind of squint, you know, they all have the same general floor plan, you know, so to speak. They all have the same general plan. But the differences are really in the microwiring, and those differences emerge in childhood all the way through adolescence. There are even some parts of the brain which are very plastic, even in adulthood. So I think the important thing to realize is that brains don't come empty. They really come awaiting a set of wiring instructions, and the world around you provides you with those wiring instructions.
Okay, so I wrote that down because that's important. We are born with genes, including in our brains, that wait for instructions on how to finish wiring. So that's the cultural and family component that you're talking about.
Yes, and in fact, experiences in the world turn on and off genes. We know this to be the case. It's called epigenetics. So even though you're born with a complement of genes, those genes are turned on and off by the environment that you live in. And there are also even genes that determine how sensitive you are to your environment. So there are some genes, some alleles of some genes, which lead you to be very, very sensitive. And for other people, they have different versions of those genes, which lead them to be somewhat less sensitive to the environment. So genes are think of them, again, as ingredients, which can be tinkered with and tweaked by the world.
So if you and I were born with similar genes, Professor Barrett, but you grew up in a calm household and I grew up in a very noisy, conflicted one, we would turn out very differently because different genes would get turned on. Our brains would be wired differently.
Yes, and in fact, we know of a case of two women, identical twins, so they have identical genes. They grew up together. They both developed an unfortunate disease at the age of 12, which calcified their amygdala, which amygdala is a little nugget of a brain region in the brain. It's important not only for emotion, but for other types of mental events. And so both of these women lost their amygdala, a major part of their amygdala, when they were 12 years old. They grew up in the same household. They grew up in the same, they went to the same high school. Their IQ is approximately the same. They live down the street from each other in the same neighborhood. But one woman has difficulties experiencing and perceiving fear, except in the most extreme cases, whereas the other twin is normal in with respect to her experiences and perceptions of fear. So these are women who share, you know, much of their experience, much of their environment. They share all of the same genes, but yet their brains took somewhat different trajectories in development, probably because of the, you know, day-to-day differences in their experiences.
Wow. All right. Well, the exchange number for you to join us, lots to think about today in the exchange, is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University, appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. We're talking about her brand new book just out next week. It's called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We'd love your questions and comments about how our brains wire themselves, how our emotions are made. They're not innate, Professor Barrett says. We're not born with a particular emotional map. It is made by the circumstances that our brains find themselves in. Again, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. So if emotions are, you know, we're completely misunderstanding or largely misunderstanding how they're made, where does that come from? I mean, you said that that it started with Plato and then more recently in the 80s. If it's so wrong, Professor Barrett, why does it persist?
That's a fantastic question. You know, when I first started thinking about writing this book, my editor wanted me to write a book that said something like, once upon a time, we believed these things about the brain, which weren't true. Modern neuroscience in the last 10 years has revealed to us the truth about emotion that we never knew before. But the truth is that there's been evidence all along that this view of emotion, which I call the classical view, is flawed. And which leads to the question of why do we maintain this belief that we have an animal brain wired with emotion circuits wrapped in rationality? Why does this persist? And I think the reason why is that it really matches our theory of human nature. You know, we have a belief, really, since the ancient Greeks, that our mind is a battleground of opposing forces, passion and reason, and that that these two are always in conflict with one another, and that one of them has to win. We've always had this idea that that this battleground is really a battleground over good and evil, right? That that emotions lead you to do these really unfortunate things. Emotions are part of your body. They lead you to do these really unfortunate things. And that rationality will come and save the day. The idea is that emotions are preformed. First, the idea was they were preformed by God. Then, with Darwin, came the idea that, no, it wasn't really God that was imbuing the human mind with emotion, but instead it was a set of genes, so that there's this omnipotent force which causes us to, you know, act in ways that we would rather not, and so on and so forth.
So it kind of gets us off the hook, right? I mean, if it's
not
our fault, then, you know, sorry I hit you, but I was upset. Oh, well.
Yeah, and in fact, the entire legal system in the United States and many other Western countries is organized around the idea that the mind is a battleground for good and evil, for emotion and rationality, and that emotions kind of somewhat reduce your culpability and responsibility for bad behavior. So this is why acts of crimes of passion are typically seen as less punishable than premeditated crimes.
Because you are presumed to have been out of control by your emotions.
Yes, exactly. The idea is that, you know, your emotions lurk in this ancient animal core of your brain, and that evolution has bestowed upon humans this prodigious, you know, cortex that controls emotions with rationality. And that's a narrative. It's a story. It's an interesting story. It makes for great movies and so on, but it's just a story. And it's a story that happens to not fit very well the anatomy of the brain. It doesn't fit what we know about evolutionary biology. And it certainly doesn't fit what we know about the nature of emotion and how emotions are made in your brain and body.
Professor Barrett, let's take a call, and then we'll talk some more on that point that you just made. But I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And from Nashua, Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I was very interested in the portion of the comments where your guest said that, I guess, even into adulthood, some portion of the brain is still plastic. And so I was kind of interested to know what part of the, you know, essentially what part of the brain can we still mold? That's the first part of it. And then the second part of this is, you know, in regards to, like, for example, those with PTSD, how does that exactly manifest itself? Is it like some kind of an experience gets seared and really burned into your circuit and that can't be changed? Or, is, you know, how would you change something like that?
Wow, two great questions, Chris. And let's take the first one first. I read a whole book a couple years ago about new research, Professor Baird, that shows that, yes, indeed, adults, don't despair, your brain still is plastic.
Absolutely. So Chris has asked two of the really important questions that scientists have been grappling with and that I provide some discussion of in my book. When an infant brain is incredibly plastic. Most of these networks that I was mentioning to you that we see in the adult brain don't even exist in an infant brain. An infant's brain has to wire itself and bootstrap into itself the knowledge that it needs to function for the rest of its life. This plasticity, as it's called, or this the ability of the brain to mold itself, is very, very intense in young childhood, all the way through to middle childhood, even into adolescence. There are some networks that take a little longer to grow or to form. Into adulthood, I think there are two ways to think about plasticity. The first is that you're always learning new things. Even though the major structural aspects of your brain won't change as an adult without illness, you're still always learning new things. Whenever you learn a new skill, for example, you are rewiring your brain. In fact, anytime you learn something new and you are able to use what you learn at another point in your life, you have, in effect, rewired your brain. You may not have grown new neurons, but you've strengthened connections by growing new so neurons have different parts to them, and even though
Professor Barrett, I'm so sorry,
I got to
jump in on you there, and we will talk more. Chris will address your second part of your question as well after a short break. Stay with us.
Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how emotions are made. Our guest says most of us are pretty clueless about this, given all the misinformation about how our brains and bodies create our feelings. She challenges long-held theories about emotions, debunked, she says, by modern neuroscience, but still shaping everything from healthcare to public safety to how the legal system works. We're talking this hour with Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University. Her new book out next week is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. We'd love to hear from you. Your questions, comments, concerns are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. What's one step that you have taken to change your emotional outlook, to try to rewire the brain, as we've been talking about? We've also looked at different cultural expressions of emotions. What different emotional expressions have you seen among people from different cultures or different countries? Again, the number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Barrett, let's finish up on Chris's call, the second part of his question. The first part was about, you know, the brain being plastic as adults. The second part was about PTSD and how it affects the brain and whether it's quote-unquote curable.
Well, PTSD is one example of a number of diseases where the brain is trapped using an old model of the world. So, you know, people used to believe that the brain sort of was silent, sat dormant, and was waiting to be stimulated by the world. But in fact, your brain is always firing. The neurons are always firing. You're actually running an internal model of the world. So the brain is simulating and predicting what's going to happen in a moment from now. It actually spends most of its time making these micro predictions about what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, and so on. So your brain is being very proactive, and it's making guesses about what's going to happen next. With PTSD, what's happening is that the brain is, its guesses are compromised. It's not guessing very well, and it's not updating its guesses based on new learning. So it's trapped in an old model, and as a consequence, people who suffer from PTSD are reliving experiences that are not driven by what's around them in the moment. They are really transported to another time and place and kind of reliving that experience. And part of the problem is that plasticity in a brain that is suffering from PTSD is compromised, meaning that day-to-day new learning, which is subtly changing the wiring of the brain, is not really happening.
Because the brain is just injured, to put it. I mean, I'm sure that's not the technical term, but the brain is definitely having a harder time readjusting to the new reality.
Exactly. It's the parts of the brain that drive plasticity are not working as well. And there are a number of reasons why they're not working as well. One of the things that makes PTSD, depression, other diseases like this very difficult to treat is that there's not one cause of the disorder. There can be many different things going wrong in a brain that compromises its ability to learn new experiences and therefore its ability to make new experiences.
Chris, thank you so much for the questions. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Professor Barrett, back to the phones. Kathy's joining us from Goffstown. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. It may be that she just answered the question, but my question coming from a school perspective is we see some students who have had horrendous home lives and other students who have had the same kind of experience, and some children are far more resilient than others based on that. And I'm curious as to A, why, and B, is there anything that schools can do to help children develop those resilient skills?
Oh, Kathy, such a good question. And I've been reading a lot about this, Professor Barrett, the idea of resiliency. Two kids from similarly difficult homes, one emerges fine and the other seems scarred for life.
There are huge individual differences, and resilience is one of the big questions that neuroscientists are grappling with right now. Here's my take on it. I think there are two aspects to building resilience. One is about what kids, the content of what they learn. So one way to help children, for example, is to teach them emotion words and build their emotion vocabulary. And I know it sounds crazy to say that teaching some concepts to some kids can transform their lives, but actually the evidence suggests that by giving children a vocabulary to be able to not only express how they feel, but also control their actions really helps. It doesn't just help with their social behavior, it also improves their academic performance, is what the research shows. But there's a second piece, not just what they learn, but also how they learn it. I think one thing that's important to realize is that we are a social species. We're all social animals. And unbeknownst to us, we regulate each other's nervous systems all the time through smell and touch and sounds and vision and even through the words that we speak. So, Kathy, if you and I were in the same room and we were talking to each other and we were trusting each other, our behaviors would synchronize. You'd nod your head. I'd nod my head. Our heartbeats would synchronize. Our respiration, our breathing would synchronize. And this means that we can actually help each other. In fact, we do help each other regulate our nervous systems. And when teachers, for example, are empathic instructing children, they are not just imparting content that will help the child, they're also helping the child regulate his or her nervous system, which, believe it or not, makes it easier for the kid to learn. And there's remarkable research showing that all it really takes to be resilient is one or two people in your life who can support your nervous system a little bit and provide you with enough empathy that you can learn what you need to learn, not only to be functional in your life, but also to be generous with yourself about your foibles.
So empathetically listening to a child, that means not yelling, making eye contact. You know, our caller asked about what teachers can do, and that's just one really simple thing.
Yeah, so there's this research that comes out of the Yale Emotional Intelligence Lab, which shows that a curriculum that focuses on mental state words, teaching children vocabulary for emotion, changes, really transforms the emotional climate of the classroom, which is probably why these kids not only improve their social behavior, but also improve their academic performance.
That's so simple, Professor Barrett. And yet you talk about that again and again in the book, the importance of a rich emotional vocabulary. So, you know, beyond just saying, I'm angry, I could say, I'm distressed, I'm worried, talk about that a little bit more, please. What a rich emotional vocabulary means and why it's so important, even though it sounds pretty simple.
It does sound simple. It sounds miraculous. I think if I weren't a scientist, I'm not sure I would believe it. But but it really is, time and time again, it's shown to be the case. So I think the way to think about it is like this. When your brain is constantly predicting, it's predicting what am I going to see next, what am I going to hear next, what should I do next, what it's using is past experience. It's using knowledge of the past to make these little micro predictions. And as a consequence, it's actually helping to regulate your body, to prepare your body to act. So what you know about emotion really influences how well, how efficiently your brain is controlling your body and how well your brain is thinking and directing action. So the more you know, the more flexibility you have, the better the mental states that you make, including emotion, will be effective in the particular situation that you're in.
Well, Kathy, great question. Thank you very much. And here's an email from Lynn who says, can you ask Dr. Barrett about the pervasive belief that depression and anxiety are caused by a chemical imbalance? Lynn says, teens are being taught this so widely that it is seen by them as fact. They often tell me that they are, quote, born with it, and even that, quote, they are just wired this way, which supports a permanence that I find detrimental to teens and young adults. Thank you so much, Lynn. What do you think? Great question.
That is a fantastic question. There's so much embedded in this question. So let me say a couple of things. The first is that something can be biological without being indelible. This is an important point. So when people say, well, emotions are not hardwired, I think, well, actually, your brain, you are your brain. Everything that goes on in your brain is chemical and electrical. So everything can be explained in terms of biology, but that doesn't mean that it's permanent. That doesn't mean that somebody is marked for life because the brain is very plastic. I think the way to think about it is your brain is a structure made of billions of neurons. That's one single structure which can take on trillions of patterns, and it can learn new patterns with the snap of a finger, assuming that you don't have an illness. So your biology is not permanent, and I think that's one really important thing. The second important thing, I think, is the notion of cause. You know, when I ask people, what do you think causes a common cold? Do you think a virus causes a common cold? Everyone, you know, who's taken, you know, some biology in high school says, sure, a virus causes a common cold.
Right.
But here's the thing. If you take 100 people and you put them in a hotel room and you place a virus in their nose and then you control everything that they have contact with, 20% of the people, between 20 and 40% will develop colds, and between 60 and 80% of people do not develop colds.
I just assume that 60% is lucky.
No. I think the important point is that a virus is necessary, but it's not sufficient for catching a cold. And so what this means about depression and anxiety, depression and anxiety are mental illnesses, but they're also they also have metabolic imbalance. They have immune imbalance. You could call them an immune disease. You could call them a metabolic disease. But the point is that having particular genes or having a particular brain structure doesn't cause depression. It predisposes you to be more likely to develop depression if the circumstances contribute. So it's exactly the same thing as catching a cold. And you wouldn't necessarily say that because you've caught several colds in your life that you are predestined to have a cold for the rest of your life and that it's unchangeable. No, in fact, you know, we know the opposite is true. And the same is also true about depression and anxiety and, frankly, every mental illness. So one important thing I deal with in my book is the idea that the mental and the physical are very, very porous. It's definitely the case that some people have genes which are more likely to lead them to experience depression under certain circumstances, but many of those people never experience depression or maybe experience it once and never experience it again. I think the brain, the environment gets into the brain. It gets under your skin and it helps to wire your brain. And it also can help to heal your brain. So just because something can be explained biologically doesn't mean that you have no responsibility or no control. You don't have as much control in the moment as you may like, but one of the things my book discusses is that the horizon of control for being able to architect your experience and avoid depression and anxiety is much, much broader and much more powerful than you might think.
So it sounds like you and Lynn, our emailer, are on the same page. You know, Lynn says, you know, she finds it detrimental when teens and young adults say, I'm just wired this way, I'm born with it. Sounds like you're on the same page with her.
Absolutely. And I think teens in particular I wrote this book really so that older teens could read it and learn from it for exactly this reason. I myself have a teenager In part, I wrote this book for her so she could understand the power of her own mind.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much. And to the phones and Reeve in Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, guys. Thanks. I have two quick comments.
Sure.
One is it's speaking to the resiliency. I'm a movement educator. I work a lot with emotions. And I one day went to the ocean. I lay down. I hadn't been there in forever. I was so excited, and flies swarmed my back. And I was anguished and miserable. They were going to wreck my day. They were just walking all over me. And I thought, either I can't get rid of the flies, I'm going to have to change my brain. So I pretended that they were fairies giving me a massage.
Oh.
And it worked so crazily well.
Seriously, Reeve? I don't think I could do that.
Oh, you really can.
No,
I don't think so.
But go ahead.
I've done this many times since, but it worked so well. First of all, it worked instantly. And secondly, it worked so well that in 10 minutes when a breeze came up, I was like, no, don't go away. So the second thing, I'll also say I've done that now many times. Not just that, but once when I was trapped at a singing camp with someone who snored. And when she started to snore, I changed my mind, and I decided it's like a lullaby. It means everybody's at peace. But the third thing I wanted to say is I had a very bad accident many years ago, and I refused all pain medication because I don't think that we should be hiding from pain. It was incredibly important for me to know which movements I made created pain and which didn't. So it wasn't that I wasn't in blinding pain sometimes, many times, for several years. But what I did do was see the pain as necessary and helpful information. So I wasn't tortured by it. And it made it possible for me to go through with zero pain meds.
Well, Reeve, you're amazing. And especially on the snoring, I think a lot of people wish they could do that. But it's hard to switch your brain around. So she's pretty good at this, Professor Barrett.
Yeah, so Reeve is bringing up two fantastic points. One has to do with the power of awe, in particular. That's the emotion that Reeve was cultivating for herself. I guess there are two things to say about this. One is that you really can provide yourself with experiences. You can learn to cultivate and curate experiences that give you much more control over your life. Awe is a terrific one. When you experience awe, you're having the feeling of being in the presence of something vastly greater than yourself, like the ocean. For me, I had one of my epiphanies was one day when I was on vacation at the beach. I discovered I could hear crickets through outside, and I could even hear them through the walls of the house as I lay quietly. And so whenever I wake up in the middle of the night on a summer night and I'm feeling anxious about the stressful day, you know, that I'm about to have in a lab or at work, I listen for the crickets because I feel like it's a blanket of nature, which helps me get back to sleep. You know, so, and I think it's possible to cultivate awe even with the smallest events. Like you can be walking on the sidewalk and see a weed poke through the crack in a sidewalk and focus on the awesome power of nature. There are many, many opportunities in the day to feel like there's something bigger than yourself, which lets you get a little bit of distance from your own problems and makes your problems seem smaller. You can also do this kind of mental transformation that Reeve was talking about. So people think, people are, sometimes they'll imagine an audience in their underwear, or I can tell you with my daughter when she was 3 years old and would wake up from a nightmare, I would sprinkle fairy dust around her bed.
I think we've all done.
Yeah,
I remember putting the monster spray under the bed. Oh. We will follow up in just a moment, taking a short break here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with the author of the brand new book out next week called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. The author is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University. She has appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. And basically, Professor Barrett says a lot of what we think about how emotions are created is wrong. We're talking about that this hour. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhpr exchange. You know, one more thing out of that phone call that we got before the break, Professor Barrett from Reeve, she talked about pain. And I did want to ask you, how our misunderstandings about emotions plays out in that doctor's office, because you write a lot about this, how doctors view our complaints is shaped by a lot of mythology around emotions.
Exactly. So in your own brain, your brain is taking in sensations from your body and it's making sense of them. It's trying to understand why you have those sensations and what to do about them. That's also what happens in a doctor's office. So their pain, for example, or any physical ailment has two parts. There's the sensations or the information that's coming from your body, and then there's your meaning-making around that. So, for example, we know that women over the age of 65 are more likely to die from a heart attack than men of a similar age, because when they go to the emergency room, they are reporting physical symptoms that the physician on call makes sense of those as anxiety, thinks that they're an example of anxiety and sends a woman home, whereas for a man, they're more likely the case that those sensations will be understood as the first signs of a heart attack, and the male patient will be given needed treatment. When you go to a physician and you complain of that you're experiencing fatigue, if they can't find any physical explanation for that fatigue, they're likely to suggest to you that you're depressed or that you're feeling stressed in some way. And that very well may be the case, but the point is that when someone suggests to you to make sense of your fatigue as depression, they are helping to create a feeling of sadness in you that you wouldn't otherwise have. Similarly, if you're feeling very worked up, and someone suggests to you that you may be anxious, they may be helping to actually create anxiety in you that otherwise wasn't there. When you take students in college math classes who suffer from test anxiety and you teach them that, first of all, getting worked up before an exam means that it could be a good thing. It could be that your brain is preparing your body to write the test, that it's not really anxiety. Instead, you could experience it as determination. Those kids not only do better on their math test, but they're actually more likely to finish college, and which has a huge impact on their future earnings. So the point here is that you can make meaning out of your body's sensations in multiple ways. When you go to see a doctor, you have to be really mindful that your doctor is also guessing at what is causing your physical symptoms, and try to approach this with some curiosity and kind of like it's a puzzle to be solved, and don't necessarily assume that your doctor knows the answer. Doctors are extraordinarily well trained, and they may know the answer, but they also may be guessing and taking you down the wrong path.
It's tricky, though, isn't it, Professor Barrett? Because you're saying we don't want doctors to dismiss our heart attack as, you know, anxiety, or dismiss our fatigue as depression. On the other hand, sometimes we kind of do? Like, maybe we keep getting this rash because we have incredibly, you know, stressful lives. So it's tough, right? I mean, you don't want them to dismiss those emotional contributors to our physical states.
Absolutely. I guess what I'm saying is that we have this pervasive belief in this culture that there is a one-to-one correspondence between a physical state and a mental state. So anxiety feels a certain way, the symptoms of a heart attack feel a certain way, and it should be possible to know the difference. That's not really how your body works, though. So when you feel worked up, you could be feeling worked up for all sorts of reasons. Your own brain is trying to guess at what those reasons might be, and in the same way that a doctor is guessing, really. Now, a doctor is guessing with no knowledge. A doctor has trained to make educated guesses, but they're still guesses. They're still guesses. So my point is that you should be curious about your physical symptoms and try to think of them as a puzzle to be solved, as opposed to the idea that you just have to uncover the one cause of that physical symptom. It's just the brain just isn't wired in that one-to-one kind of way.
Let's take another call, and this is Alice in Laconia. Hi, Alice. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Barrett, I'd like to find out what she thinks about antidepressants. Can they be useful or not in treating depression?
And what do you think, Alice? Okay. I guess Alice just wanted to ask the question. Go ahead, Professor Barrett.
I think that antidepressants can be helpful in adjusting the chemicals in the brain, but they don't cure depression on their own. I think that's very well known at this point. So I think about depression as kind of a locked-in brain. Your brain is running this internal model of the world. It's trying to predict what's going to happen next, but it's not doing a very good job because it's not adjusting to its current circumstances. So it's kind of trapped in this negative world.
Like that PTSD brain you described earlier, yeah.
They're very similar, actually. They're very similar in that way. And one thing to understand about your brain is it's, as I said, it's a network of billions of neurons, and these neurons are bathed in a chemical system which make it harder or easier for the little neurons to pass information to one another, which means these chemicals make it harder or easier for people to learn new things, to learn to experience things that are more consistent with the world around them at the present moment. And so when the chemical balance is slightly off, that makes it much harder for neurons to learn new things, for people to learn new things. So what antidepressants do is they adjust the level of those chemicals, and which makes it easier for the brain to now learn new things. The problem is, of course, that if your environment hasn't changed, you're not going to learn new things.
So it enables healing, but it doesn't mean create healing.
Exactly. It enables healing. It doesn't create healing. So again, if you think about a brain as waiting a set of instructions for wiring itself, what antidepressants do is they help the brain get itself into a state where it's receptive to those new instructions, to those new experiences. But alone, it's not going to cure depression.
I want to ask you about another part of the book, Professor Barrett, that gets more into sort of public policy and politics. And this is how the way our brain works affects public safety policy, you know, from police conduct. You know, we've seen videos of police shooting, you know, unarmed people running away, and we think, how can they do that? To how people are treated in the courts, to how your average citizen walks around, you know, feeling what level of safety he or she feels. Talk, if you could, please, a little bit about how this, your understanding of the brain, impacts our views on public safety.
Well, in if you look at the wiring of the brain, what you can see is that the regions of the brain which are responsible for initiating the predictions, which become our experience, are also the regions that control the body. The upshot of this is that the regions that control the body cause changes in our physical systems in our body, make our hearts race, our breathing change, and so on and so forth. And we experience these as feelings of pleasant or unpleasant, as a feeling of danger or safety. So what this means is that at the heart of every perception that we have about the world, we have at the heart of that is also these feelings of feeling pleasant or unpleasant, feeling safe or feeling like there's danger. Said another way, it's not the case that you see things and then you feel something. It's the case that feeling is determining what you see. Your feelings are part of what direct your brain to see. So what this means is that it's very possible for police officers who are working in dangerous situations to see weapons that aren't really there. It's very possible for soldiers and other military personnel to see weapons where weapons don't actually exist. And as a consequence, they can do harm an officer can pull a gun and shoot someone because they actually believe that they can see something that's actually not there.
So their minds their mind's eye basically creates something that isn't there.
Yeah, and this is actually the normal way that the brain works. It works this way for a really good reason, and that is that by the time that you consciously see something, it takes you about 600 to 800 milliseconds, so almost a full second, to physically act, which is why your brain starts to prepare your actions before you can consciously see things. If the brain didn't work that way, we wouldn't have baseball, we wouldn't have tennis, we wouldn't have football, we wouldn't have any of these games. But it's also the case that in a war or some kind of dangerous situation, if somebody had to wait to consciously see a gun before they pulled their own gun, they'd be dead.
So it makes sense.
It makes sense, I think, from the wiring of the brain. Now, of course, you have these situations. Look, you have these situations where police officers have been known to shoot people in the back as they're running away. That's not what I'm talking about here, right? I'm talking about a situation where somebody moves their hand towards their pants, or they're holding a cell phone or a keys, or they just even make a movement that looks like they're going to draw a weapon. The police officer, for better or for worse, this is a politically neutral statement, right? It's a neuroscience statement. The police officer's brain is going to be making predictions about what he or she is going to see next. And so the likelihood that they will miss-see, especially in a circumstance that's very high in arousal, is very high. Now, there was a case in, I think, 2006 or 2007 where some military personnel in a helicopter shot and killed a Reuters photographer who was holding a camera. And if you listen to the transcripts, you can hear that the soldiers in the helicopter thought they saw a machine gun, right? And it's very, very easy for that to happen in a high arousal situation, particularly when you have the systems that are guiding your body are also issuing predictions to the rest of your brain for what you should be able to perceive and experience. So we are wired to see and hear and taste what we feel, not the other way around. This is this has really important implications for things like stand your ground laws and other types of legal matters, I think.
So as you keep saying, the brain is constantly making predictions. And when you're in a high stress situation, like a police officer or like a soldier in a war zone, your brain makes those predictions before it has the data to know whether those predictions are right or not.
Yes, exactly. Think about your brain like it's a scientist. It's actually making predictions, and then the incoming information from the world in the next moment is either confirming those predictions or changing them.
But those predictions are based on past experience.
Exactly. They're based on past experience, which may be your experience, or it may be things that you've seen on television or read in books. So, for example, you know, if you look at television at 10 o'clock on any given evening, you see a lot of cop shows, there are lots of movies about cops, and those entertaining stories actually help to wire your brain in a way that lead you to expect certain things and to not expect other things. We think about television as this entertainment device, but it actually has very powerful impact on the kinds of expectations that brains are wired to create. And I should say, when I'm talking about your brain predicting, this is not something that you have access to. It's not something, as I explain in the book, and I have some illustrations to demonstrate to you so that you can get a feel for how this works, this is not something that you have conscious control over. It happens in the blink of an eye. It's just happening all the time. You can influence how your brain is predicting by changing your context, by changing what you pay attention to in the moment will change your predictions in the future. You can expose yourself to new experiences. You can cultivate exposure to new situations and thereby change the store of knowledge in your brain that it can use to predict in the future. But in the moment, you don't have any control over the kinds of predictions that your brain is constructing. It's doing it very automatically outside of your awareness.
What's the one message? There's so much in this book, Professor Barrett. What's the one message that you hope people take away from our conversation today?
You are an architect of your own experience. You have much more control than you believe. People think about control as trying to change their experience in the moment. But it's very hard to just snap your fingers and change how you feel in the moment. Some people find it utterly impossible to do. That's not necessarily the way to go about it. There are many, many things that you can do to change how you feel tomorrow by changing what you expose yourself to, what you cultivate, and so on today.
Well, that's an encouraging message. I really appreciate you being with us, Professor Barrett. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Lisa Feldman Barrett, Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University. Her brand new book is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. We're also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. You can check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes photos here in The Exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.